It's 9:06.
Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. Well, in case you've been vacationing on Mars for the past couple of years, you know that there's a presidential election next Tuesday. Millions of Americans will go to the polls and cast their ballots in favor of one candidate or another, or in some cases, against. The one who gets the most votes should win, right? Well, not so fast. We really don't elect our presidents directly. The Electoral College is who elects our president. But should it? Is it time to do away with this relic created by the Founding Fathers? Or is it still working, and should we keep it? Well, those are questions we'll tackle this hour. My guest is John C. Fortier, director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center and author of After the People Vote, A Guide to the Electoral College. Good morning, Mr. Fortier, and welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Good morning to you.
Well, let's start with some definitions. What exactly is the Electoral College?
Well, there is no such one body. In fact, it wasn't even called that at the beginning. I think you start from the fact that we really run our elections not as one election nationally, but we run our elections in 50 states plus the District of Columbia. And when people are going to the polling places to vote, they may think they're voting for Mitt Romney or for Barack Obama, but really they are voting for a group of people called electors. And there are a certain number of electors from each state, roughly based on population. We can talk about exactly how they're calculated. But and those electors in almost all the states are selected by the winner of the popular vote in the state. The winner of the state takes all of the electors. Those electors show up in their state capitals. They don't meet as one, and that's why it's not really one institution, the Electoral College, but it's 51 different meetings of these electors across the country to cast their votes. The electors who were selected by states who picked Barack Obama will cast their votes for Barack Obama. Those who were selected in states that Romney won will vote for Romney. And then the Congress will ultimately open those votes and count them in the next session in January. And assuming there are no problems there, we'll count those votes, proclaim a winner, and then we will officially have a president-elect who will then take office on January 20th. So it's a state-by-state election. There are these intervening people called electors, not very well known by the public. They cast their votes in December, and eventually we have a president of the United States.
So are the electors bound to vote in a certain way, or can they say, okay, you elected me, but I'm not voting that way?
Well, it's a good question. They are more or less bound, but not perfectly bound. The people who become electors on a slate are loyal to the candidate and to the party of that state. So, if again in a close state, in one of the competitive states, let's say Wisconsin, there's a group of people now who are loyal supporters of Mitt Romney, who are expected to cast their votes for Mitt Romney, who are on one slate, and if Wisconsin votes for Mitt Romney, those people will be the people who vote in Madison in December. There's another slate of people who are loyal to Barack Obama who will do the same if Barack Obama wins the state. So it's very unlikely that they will vote other than they should. And there are some states which have some rules about trying to bind them to their choices. Most of those states have very, very small penalties, a few hundred dollars. There's a state that North Carolina, which tries to say that if an elector voted the wrong way, they'll be replaced by another person immediately. It's not clear that that's workable or constitutional, but there's a presumption that they'll be bound. There's some minor rules that they'll be bound, but occasionally we do have an elector cast a vote in the way they shouldn't vote. It's never been consequential. It's usually kind of a protest vote. I remember Michael in 1988 when George Bush for the first was running against Michael Dukakis. One of the Dukakis electors switched their votes. They voted for Lloyd Bentsen, the vice presidential candidate, as president. They voted for Michael Dukakis as vice president. It happens when the candidates, when the electors know that the college is not close, that they want to make a point. But in theory, it could happen if it were a very close election where a so-called faithless elector would change their mind.
Mm-hmm. So where did the term Electoral College come from?
You know, that's a good question. That came about later. Where the idea came from in the beginning, it's interesting. At the start of the Constitutional Convention, the presidency was really, and how to elect the president, was really considered last. What had to be worked out first was representation in Congress, and then secondly, the question of whether the president would be separately elected from Congress. And so it took the founders a long time to figure out the Senate and the House. It was a compromise, one being based more on representation of the people and one on the states. And only after that, near the end of the convention, did the founders settle on this way to elect the president. So it didn't have a name particularly. It was a presidential selection system. It certainly had electors. Those were mentioned in the Constitution. But the general terminology arrived later.
Was there some example in how some other country did things that the founding fathers looked at, or where did this idea come from, and what was its original purpose?
Well, there were several purposes, some of which are relevant today, and some of which are probably not. There weren't exact models of this in other places, but I mentioned the one big decision that had to be made, which other countries today have to make, is whether the legislature should directly elect the president. And the founders eventually settled on the idea that no, they should be separately elected. And that's one of the reasons we have these electors elected. It's not members of Congress voting for the president like they would vote for a prime minister, essentially, in a parliamentary system. It's this group that's created just for this purpose of electing the president. Now you say, well, why wouldn't you have a national popular vote at the time? Well, there were a couple of things. One was logistics. It was difficult to imagine that this 13 states, far-flung transportation and communication was hard to find among the states, that you would have an easy way of conducting the popular vote. A second was that even today, but certainly back then, we have different rules in our states of how to vote. And the way America is very different from other countries in that we allow different voting hours in different places. We even allow some different rules about who might vote. Today it's a smaller group of people about felons, whether they can vote, whether they can vote after they are have served their time. Some states have different rules about that. But in the day, back in the time of the founding of the country, we had very, very different rules about who might vote, landowners or different classes of people. And, of course, we also had the very big issue of slavery, which was compromise, of course, was the Three-Fifths Compromise, which was a compromise which dealt with representation in Congress, but ultimately also, you know, affected the Electoral College. Some states which had slaves and were not going to let them vote, the question of how would those people count towards the size of the state and how they're represented or not. And because we had some very different rules in different states, the founders thought, well, we can't just have a national popular vote. We have all sorts of different franchises all around. We have to assess a certain value for each place. One other factor, which is not really so relevant today, but the founders were really worried about people only knowing the candidates from their own states. And the original Electoral College looked a little different than it does today. Today you have electors cast one vote for president and one vote for vice president. The original version of the Electoral College, the electors would cast two votes, and you would not specify. You would cast two votes for president. And the founders thought that, well, perhaps one of those votes will be a home state son, the governor of the state, or a prominent person in your local state. And then the other person, they required that you vote for somebody not from your state. And that was where they hoped they would find people of national reputation. I mean, George Washington was an obvious one, but they were worried that there wouldn't be enough people of national reputation, that there would be a lot of fragmenting of the votes, that individual states would just elect their local people. And so they encouraged this second vote to be the one that really cast about for national figures that could serve as president. Ultimately, that broke down in the election of 1800, where Thomas Jefferson ended up tied with the person who was supposed to be his vice president, Aaron Burr. So he essentially had two people tying, and that dispute went on for a very long time until ultimately the other side, when Alexander Hamilton helped elect Thomas Jefferson to be the president, and then we changed our Electoral College. But you know, one of the concerns of the original proposal was, you know, we want to make sure we have people electing national figures and not just home state people.
Well, we certainly don't have that problem today because all the ways we can communicate and so forth seems like we have nothing but national figures these days.
That's true, although interestingly, we do tend to take people from governorships and states, and in other ways, we find that those governors who are really, you know, not Washington figures get to be known. I mean, Mitt Romney's had to go through that process, and Barack Obama's a bit of an exception, having served in Washington. But if you look back at Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter, it's common for us to elect some people out in the states who've never served in Washington before. And there is a process that we have of getting to know those candidates. It's a long primary process, and of course the modern communications. But it was much more severe, of course, in the early days, where there was not a sense that we had one country as much as we had some disparate states.
Mm-hmm. So it's 2012. We certainly have a whole lot better means and faster means. Well, I don't know about better, but we certainly have a lot faster means of communicating about who people are and what they stand for and so forth than they had in 1800. In the 1790s, clearly communication has increased. Some would question whether it's improved. So we don't have that issue any longer. People, even governors, become nationally known very quickly, and so forth. So we don't. Some of the problems that they were thinking about in those when they were creating this stuff no longer exist. So why don't we just do away with this Electoral College? Why do we still have it?
Well, if you look at polls, and this has been true for the last 30 or 40 years, a majority of people, 60, 65% of people, really think we probably should have a national popular vote. One simple reason we don't do away with it is because, at least until recently, most people thought that the way of changing it would be through a constitutional amendment. And while 60 to 65% of the people is pretty good, amending the Constitution is going to require two-thirds of Congress, three-quarters of the states, and the efforts that moved in that direction failed. They just didn't get enough traction. What are some of the reasons of having the Electoral College? Well, one argument is that all systems have some issues, and the national popular vote might seem like a good thing on the face of it, but even the people who are for that aren't sure what type of national popular vote. Would you have a simple national popular vote where the plurality winner wins, that five or six candidates could win, but the winner with 35% of the vote becomes the president? Alternatively, would you have a runoff? Would you have in some states that the top two in the first round then go on to face off in the second round of the presidential system? There are even some ways of ranking votes that might do all that in one system together. So that there's some disagreement as to how you would change it, and I think that's plagued some of the people who are trying to reform the college. The big arguments against it are, one, of course, like 2000 and like several times in the 19th century, the popular vote can go in one direction, and the Electoral College vote can go in the other direction. Now, while that's true, it's not that common for it to happen, and it's likely that it would have to be an extremely close national popular vote. That still is an argument that people strongly believe in. It's not fair to be elected with less than half the vote. But you do have it only in some pretty close elections. It's unlikely to happen. And ultimately, if people know the rules, one might argue that you have to get these states. You might have run a different campaign otherwise. So maybe that national popular vote would have come out another way. Another argument people make against it is, well, what about the unfairness of the difference of treatment between states? Small states are better represented in the Electoral College. States get electors mostly based on population because they get a number of electors based on how many people they have in Congress, in the House of Representatives. California has 53 members in the House of Representatives. They get 53 electors. And then every state gets two more electors for just being a state. And so California ends up with 55. But those small states, the Delawares and the Dakotas, end up with three. And they're a little bit overrepresented. And one person, one vote does not is not met by the Electoral College. On the other side of that, I think I would say that you do not have a great partisan divide in that. The small states are split among Republicans and Democrats. D.C. votes, that's a Democratic state, obviously that's a small state, as well as some of the Republican states out west. The states with two representatives are similarly split. And it's not clear that the Electoral College has a great partisan disadvantage for one party or the other. In fact, in 2000, it looked like perhaps that Al Gore would win the Electoral College and George Bush would win the popular vote. That was the prediction if it were going to happen, and it ended up the other way. And I know today we can make some predictions that, you know, perhaps Barack Obama has an advantage in the Electoral College and maybe Mitt Romney has a bit of an advantage in the popular vote. But, you know, these things are all pretty well within the margin of error, and it wouldn't surprise me to see it go the other way, or actually more than that, I think it would not surprise me to see one of them win by a point or two, and then the Electoral College states all come along with them. So, but again, the arguments for it, I think, are that it isn't working as badly, maybe, as some people think. Two, that it does tend to promote a two-party system. To really compete in America, you have to have a broad party that at least competes in several regions around the country. You can't win with just a regional candidate, like some of the Southern Dixiecrat candidates who ran for president would win electors, but they couldn't really win at all because they were too concentrated in one area. And it takes states seriously. States still are important parts of the political culture in America. Our elections are all run differently in each state, and so, you know, the idea of having to go around and win states rather than just win sort of general parts of the population is attractive to some people.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will have some callers, I think, with some questions or comments, and you could be one of them. Here's first the phone number, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. The address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, and you can look for the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there, and I'll share it with the listening audience. So, what do you think? Is the Electoral College a relic of the past? Should we assign it to the dustbin of history, or is it something we should keep? Do we need it? And tell us why. Why do you think we should keep the Electoral College, or why do you think we should directly elect our president by popular vote, and how do you think that would work? Why do you think we should do that or not do it? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 25 minutes past 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen today. Coming up later on today, well, the average person finds health care and insurance to be frustrating, complicated, intimidating, and expensive. Join Ben Marins and his guests today at 3 o'clock as they discuss health care from the patient's perspective, including how to navigate the health care system and become a better consumer. That's on At Issue with Ben Marins today at 3. This hour, we're talking about the Electoral College. Some people say, well, you know what, it's not 1790 anymore, and we maybe should have a different way of electing our president. And others say, whoa, not so fast. It served us well for 200 years, and we need to keep it. Well, which side of that fence are you on? Or maybe you don't care so much about that. You have some other issue regarding the Electoral College or the direct election, whatever. Let's hear from you. 800-642-1234. talk@WPR.org is the email address. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. My guest is John Fortier, director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He's also author of the book, After the People Vote, A Guide to the Electoral College. And, boy, we have a lot of people all of a sudden on the phone who want to join in on this topic. So let's go to the phones, and we'll start in Polk County and hear from Jim. Oh. Jim, good morning.
Yeah, I have 1,000 questions. I'll just try to get one and a half out. Number one, we have a lot of Americans that are disenfranchised in the people that pay taxes and get drafted. People of Puerto Rico and Guam and places like that can't vote for president, as I understand it, because they were able to vote in the primaries. And the other issue is not all the states handle the Electoral College the same. Nebraska and I think Maine, and then there's movement afoot in California to change it. If it's going to be, I think it should be the same. The president is the president of the United States.
Well, you're absolutely right. There's some differences. Certainly, the territories are not voting for Congress, don't have a voting representative in Congress, or for the presidential election. D.C., interestingly, is sort of a mixed case where, by constitutional amendment, it is now voting in the presidential elections but does not have representation in Congress. But on your second point, it is true that the states actually have some leeway as to how they assign the electors. And most of the states, 48 of the states and the District of Columbia, have a winner-take-all system. If you win Wisconsin by one vote, you're going to get all the electors for yourself. Two states, Maine and Nebraska, have a district system. Again, you get Maine has four electors, two for being state having two senators and two for number of representatives they have, and Nebraska has three and two, so they have five. But if you win the state, you get the two electors for winning the state, and then you get an elector for each of the congressional districts that you win. And for many years, it was something of an interesting oddity in following these things because it had actually never split between the candidates. The candidates had always won them all, except in 2008, where Barack Obama won one of the districts in Nebraska. So he got one electoral vote from Nebraska, while John McCain got the other four. This is, early in our history, we had all sorts of ways of states casting the votes, including the state legislatures directly casting the votes, not having a popular election or having complicated district systems. But interestingly, this feature of the Electoral College is one that is used by a new reform effort that's been around for several years called the National Popular Vote Initiative. And that is, they want to see a national popular vote, but the efforts to amend the Constitution are very, very difficult. And so their insight is, if a number of states got together and said, we will give the winner of our we will give all of our electors in our state to the winner of the national popular vote. So no matter what happens in our state, we're going to instruct our electors to vote for the winner of the national popular vote. And if you got enough states together that added up to 270 in the Electoral College, that would be a majority, then effectively you will have changed the system to a national popular vote without having to amend the Constitution. You'll still have the electors meeting. They'll still meet in December. You won't have a direct national popular vote. But those electors will end up all voting, or at least enough of the states will vote so that someone gets a majority of the Electoral College if they end up with a national popular vote initiative. And I believe it's 11 states now have passed something like this. It's tended to be more Democratic states voting for it early on, not so much Republican states. And it will be interesting to see if some of the swing states and Republican states will join them, because that will be necessary to get to 270. But they're well on their way to at least more than half of what they need of states to get to the magic 270.
Now that would be a huge change, because there are the way the system is now, with most of the states being winner take all, so you can lose by 28 points in one state, and it doesn't really matter, because if you lost by one vote, it would still be a loss. And you could similarly win in a narrow vote in another state and get all those electors. And that really is what creates the kind of, I don't know if you want to call it tension or not, but the drama of the Electoral College. And it tends to diminish, in some respects, the power of some, even though they have a lot more electoral votes at stake, the power of some of the larger population areas, or areas that tend to always vote one way or the other.
Right. One of the big criticisms of the Electoral College, which I'm not sure we talked about enough, is that the campaign is focused on a number of states. Again, Wisconsin is one of those states, and so is getting a lot of attention. My state of Virginia did not used to be a swing state, and now is, and so we see a lot of television ads. But if you go to Wyoming or Rhode Island or big states like California, New York, Texas, you don't have a significant presidential campaign going on. The candidates aren't visiting. The ads aren't being run, and it's concentrated in a number of swing states rather than nationally.
Let's go back to the phones. Ron in Grafton joins us next. Ron, good morning.
Good morning. I am in favor of eliminating the Electoral College, but until then, we have a problem, potential problem, and that is if there is a tie. Now, what genius didn't figure that out and say we can't have a tie situation? Because if it does tie, then they have to go to the House of Representatives, and the way that the states work out, the Republican would win. because there are more states with Republican majority legislators than there are Democratic, which is kind of a stupid thing to do.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the actually principle is even slightly broader than that. Essentially, if someone does not get a majority of the electoral votes, again, 270 is a majority, a tie would be 269 to 269. Or if there were a third party that were to win some electors to keep somebody from getting to that magic 270, if that happens, then the first round of the Electoral College essentially doesn't work, and the decision goes to the House of Representatives. Or it's actually a little more complicated than that, in that the presidential decision goes to the House of Representatives, and the vice presidential decision goes to the Senate. So in theory, and you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see Republicans in control of the House, Democrats in control of the Senate, you could end up with a Mitt Romney, Joe Biden the ticket, or perhaps a Barack Obama, Paul Ryan ticket running the country for the next 4 years. The other point, which the caller didn't mention explicitly, is that the system of voting in the House of Representatives is not the normal system. So if it goes to the House of Representatives, it's not just a straight up and down majority vote of the people who are the new representatives, but it is done by state delegation. And essentially you have to get a majority of states, not just a majority of votes or plurality, but 26 states, state delegations voting for your candidate to be elected president. So it does look like Republicans, because they have significant control of the House and are probably going to retain it in at least a number of key areas, will have that majority of, you know, 26, I think they may have 26 to 28 delegations after the election, and that would mean that they would have something of the advantage. If it ends up a tie, the greater likelihood is that the president will be Mitt Romney than it is Barack Obama.
And Ron, thanks for that call. Let's go to Iguda in Pewaukee.
Yes, good morning to you, and thank you for taking my call. I'm in favor of removing the electoral vote. And I think that, but overall, I believe that all the system of voting for president should be reformed, and wonder if there is any process or anything that's moving toward that direction. I think the idea that there's amount of money it's spending on trying to get elected to president and all that, it just fell. And I don't think that we're seeing two parties here that are controlling this country, and then wondering if there is anything happening toward that.
Well, you know, the caller's right that there's a lot that goes in the electoral system in addition to the Electoral College. We certainly have single-member districts. That's something sometimes people complain about that tends to favor two parties. Some are in favor of having systems that would encourage more third and fourth parties. The question of campaign finance is a significant one. You know, on that, I think we're reasonably deadlocked in Washington about what to do about it, and so the system, through a combination of the courts and regulatory bodies and congressional inaction, has created, you know, the system we have today. But yeah, the Electoral College system does not stand alone. There's a lot that goes, you know, our primary system, a lot that goes into this to think about. When we had the meltdown in Florida in 2000, a lot went wrong. One thing that people pointed to was the Electoral College vote went for Bush and the popular vote went for Gore. But the biggest set of concerns was really about our voting machines and voting registration systems and the way we cast votes. And that's where the reform efforts were guided more so than changing the Electoral College.
And thanks for that call. Let's go to Wausau next and hear from Ben, because I think he's got a great follow-up to what you just talked about in 2000. Ben, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question of our guest, whose opinions I'm really enjoying, and that is, the Electoral College was not allowed to work in the election of 2000. Instead, the Supreme Court became involved, and I wonder how that option developed, and I'll take your answer off the air.
Well, it is. It's a good question, and you know, there are some complicated pieces to this when we have a disputed election. You know, just to put one other historical point on the table, 2000, of course, we all remember and how it came down to one state and how it was disputed. If you really liked 2000, you would have loved the election of 1876, which was four states having significant problems in their elections. And really, we didn't resolve that election until 2 days before Inauguration Day, which was in March back then. So It could have been worse, but the caller's right that there was some question of whether the court would step in or not. Both there's partisan questions of would it benefit one side or not, but if for some reason the court did not step in and the dispute had proceeded, I mean, I think some people hoped, well, maybe the recount would have resolved it one way or the other, but another possibility would be like 1876, where really Republicans would have said, well, this count was the real fair count, and the Secretary of State would certify that, and maybe the court order recount would have a different result, and the court or the Attorney General or someone would certify the other result, and then you'd have two sets of election results going to Washington. And again, that is what happened in 1876, where ultimately, once the electors cast their votes, Congress has to open up these votes and say, well, here's the count. And there can be disputes about that. It's, again, a pretty rare case. It's this 1876 precedent. But how they would count them, which ones they would throw out, is a little bit open to discussion. And while I don't think that's a reason for the court necessarily to have jumped in, it would have been an extremely messy process in Congress in the weeks after the court ruled had that not happened. So there's a set of processes that might result in Congress directly voting on the president if it's very clear that no one has a majority. But there's also another set of circumstances is if we really do have a dispute about a state and we can't resolve it, Congress is going to have to try to resolve that. But there's no perfect way to do that. And you can imagine a divided Congress with a House of one party and the Senate of the other party trying to count votes in a disputed state. That's why I think no state out there wants to be the Florida of 2000, because it could even drag on longer than it did in 2000, where the court, whether you liked it or not, put an end to it in December. There's another process that would take place in January in Congress, which would continue the dispute.
And the 1824 election actually did go to Congress, and that's John Quincy Adams had almost 40,000 fewer votes than Andrew Jackson, but neither candidate won a majority of the Electoral College, and Adams became the president because the House of Representatives said so. So that has happened in the past, and I suppose it could happen again.
Right, and that was a case of a four-candidate race where four candidates got electoral votes, and so they were split. No one had a majority. Today, with the two candidates, really the only way that could happen so directly would be the tie, because the 269-269 is what deprives someone of getting the majority of 270. But the other very ugly scenario is the dispute over state, where we're not sure how many electors they have, like 1876 or a little bit like 2000.
All right. We have some phone lines that have just opened up. If you want to get in on this discussion, if you have a question about the Electoral College and how it works and why we still have it, and maybe you've got an opinion that you think it should stay or you think it should go, you think we should directly elect the president, whatever, here's your chance to be heard. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn program on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. Let's see. I think we need to go to a break now, and we'll do that and come back. We have some more callers, and we'll have more with my guest, John Fortier, director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He's also author of After the People Vote, A Guide to the Electoral College. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:43. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to be talking about the United States Special Forces, the Green Berets. There's a new book out about their activities in Afghanistan, and we'll be discussing that after the news at 10. This hour, we're talking about the Electoral College. We have been getting a lot of the history of the Electoral College and finding out how it works, and we know that you still have questions. There's still a phone line or two that might be available for you if you call. And if you do get a busy signal, please use our email address, talk@wpr.org, or leave a message for us on Facebook. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to the phones again. We'll hear next from Greg in Appleton. Greg, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I wanted to call with, I guess it developed into two questions as I was hearing it, or two comments. The first one is, I believe that we should get rid of the Electoral College for the simple fact that right now, the U.S. presidential election, and realistically that's the only major one, but it's decided by seven states. There's no incentive for, say, a Democrat to go out and vote in Texas. Anything that's not a swing state, we don't have any idea what kind of voter turnout we would have in the popular vote when it's been solidly red or solidly blue for the last six decades. So we would see a massive difference there. Plus, we would see a huge difference in the campaign tactics. And money wouldn't go as far. We wouldn't be able to bombard a single state with nearly as much. The other comment that I wanted to make was on the Electoral College having the ability to arbitrarily change a vote, that it's illegal, but the vote is still valid. So if somebody in Congress were to decide to cast their vote in a way that their state said no, then they could be prosecuted for it, but that would be it for them.
Sure. Well, on the faith of the electors, I think you're right in practice that it could happen, or in theory it could happen, but likely in practice it wouldn't, just because the electors are very loyal to their candidates. There was a candidate, elector, I believe 2000 or 2004, from West Virginia, who was threatening to perhaps not vote for George Bush, even though he was elected as a Republican elector. But again, I think these tend to be more protest votes. I think the other question you raise about the campaign techniques, or the way our elections are really focused on a few states, are absolutely true. And that's one of the big arguments against it, that you spend a lot of time in some key states, but you don't spend a lot of time in most of the other states. On the other side, the argument is that, well, you'd have to make some choices anyway as a campaign. You don't have unlimited resources, and you might not put those resources in seven states if you were going for the national popular vote, but you might really just concentrate on cities, or maybe just on parts of your base and running up the score. And so there's always somebody who's left out, somebody who's getting less attention than the others. But it is a significant criticism that there are only some states being given attention. Some other states get attention for raising money, some in the primaries, but still the totality of the states is not really in play. But again, one other argument on the other side is that the swing states are the close states, the states of the middle. They're less polarized. You have to win in places that there's more of a division of opinion. So, right now, where the candidates are essentially spending money in seven or eight states, I think there's some testing of a few other states here and there, but the number realistically might get up to 11 or 12, but certainly nowhere close to 50.
Well, and those states they tend to change over time. You brought up Virginia wasn't a swing state until recently. Wisconsin hasn't always been a swing state. There have been some presidential elections where Wisconsin hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention at all. And not all parts of even the swing states get very much attention. You're not going to see too many, for example, you're not going to see the Republican candidate for president visit Douglas County in Wisconsin, because it's pretty heavily Democratic. And then some counties just don't have much population. You're just not going to see them. We will get a lot of TV ads, of course, but even within states, you have areas that just aren't going to be relevant to presidential campaign. And there are choices that have to be made about elections. But these things shift. The population of the United States has shifted over time, and it will probably continue to do so. Who knows where the next wave is going to go and what that's going to do to the landscape. So, it's not as if the map of the United States, even though the boundaries are static, the population certainly hasn't remained so.
No, that's true. We have had shifting states. It has also been true in recent years, and this may not last forever, is that we have had also a shrinking number of competitive states. We used to have more states that were in play. We tend to have fewer today. But your point about the way in which you campaign within a state is perhaps relevant for what would happen in a national popular vote. I mean, certainly I think you'd see Republican candidates going to Republican areas of the country trying to gin up their base, and Democratic candidates going to Democratic areas. They might spend some time in the swing states as well, but you know, they're going to have to make some choices, and you know, a fair amount of that might be really trying to get to the base rather than get to the middle.
Well, elections are won by whichever side gets their people to go to the polls and vote, and so that would, you know, that's always the strategy in one form or another, but it would probably be a lot more intense if we did not have the Electoral College. Let's go back to the phones and hear from Sue in Scandinavia, Wisconsin. Sue, good morning.
Good morning. If I remember my civics correctly, I think that the institution of the Electoral College, and you may have discussed this, stop me if you did, had to do with the fact that voters in urban areas have a tendency to have a different view of government and role of government than voters in rural areas. And I think you just talked about population shifts and how that affects presidential election. I personally fear the direct popular election because I think it disrespects areas of the country that are more rural where population is not as dense. Same philosophy as, you know, our two-part voting body, legislatively speaking. I mean, we have two senators for that purpose, to, you know, represent more rural areas. I'm far more concerned with, or less concerned with, Democrat versus Republican and who gets an advantage. I'm disappointed that some of the other callers in that, you know, in their tone, it is an us get a versus them situation as far as proposing changes to the electoral system. I think we need to continue to be concerned with fairly representing all Americans in all walks of life. And I think that as time goes on here, I see rural America getting the short end of the stick in that regard. And I think we have to remember that a very large part of our gross national product is our agriculture, is agribusiness.
Well, it's true. One of the arguments over the years has been that if a shift to the national popular vote would probably mean a shift in campaigns to ones that, you know, ran a lot of ads in big metropolitan areas, because that's where the you know, larger portion of the people are, and that candidates really wouldn't have any incentive to go out to the rural areas. You know, on the other side of that, it's true that candidates go to some rural areas today because they're in swing states, but of course they still ignore other large rural areas. There aren't candidates going to Wyoming because it's not a swing state, and Republicans are going to win that state. And so it's only selected rural populations that they're addressing in some swing states.
Thanks for the call, Sue. Let's go to Clyde in Cedarburg next. Clyde, good morning.
Good morning. I think the National Popular Vote Compact is an excellent reform that uses the Constitution. If you can make improvements in the system without changing the Constitution, that's the right way to do it. And so it's an excellent approach. But there are other important issues. One about the Electoral College puts the focus on states and not on people. But people are the ones that vote, and people should have a meaningful vote. If we have, with the current way that the Electoral College system works, with the one majority take all for the states, large numbers, a huge number of people have basically meaningless votes. They're discounted, and there's no, the campaign does not address itself to the concerns of the great majority of the people. It's focused on the very few undecided people and the very few swing states. Also, the other thing, and one reason that we can't get this or having trouble getting it, is because the two major parties are both opposed, in spite of the vast majority of the people being in favor of three important reforms. And one is to amend the Constitution to declare that a corporation is not a person and money is not speech, and instant runoff voting so that we can have a number of parties running and a number of candidates running, and we're not wasting our votes by voting for someone other than the majority party. And the third is the National Popular Vote Compact. Those three things would mean that we would soon have a government that's actually buying for the people instead of buying for the corporations and the super rich.
All right, Clyde, thanks.
Let me go ahead and respond. The National Popular Vote Initiative, which the caller referenced, and it's true that it's much more likely to be successful than a constitutional amendment, and it really has galvanized the people who are for a national popular vote but didn't know what kind of national popular vote to really focus on this one area. One of the difficulties, though, is it would be something of a hybrid system, and if basically states are now casting their votes for the winner of the national popular vote, what if you have a close national popular vote? What if you have an election that you say, well, we should probably have some sort of recount? Well, interestingly, since most of those states in this system would not be really voting on the results of their own state, you could have a case where lots of states were not very close, but the national popular vote was close, but you have no way to recount the votes because, again, everything would still be dependent on state law. State law would determine if it's close enough in this state, we'll have a recount here, and if it's not close enough in this state, we won't have a recount there. So some of the practical difficulties of how the system will be implemented, even if the states were to pass it, are important. One other point about the states favoring states, not people. I wouldn't say that's exactly true. The Electoral College favors the people within states, and it causes candidates to go find majorities within states, go get the most votes from the people within a state. That's a little bit different than just saying it's the state's interest or asking what the state thinks. But it's true that it leads to a certain sort of inequality that you have if you're not looking for the whole electorate, but you're looking for certain parts.
Let's try and get a couple more calls in here before the top of the hour. Mike in Madison, go ahead. Mike, go ahead.
Yes, I'm in favor of the Electoral College. I think we need to remember that this could very much be just like a light switch changing from any focus at all in Wisconsin and Iowa, the smaller states, to all the focus on the coastal states, California, New York, all the major population centers. What reason at all would a candidate have to go to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, La Crosse, Wisconsin, Dubuque, Iowa for tens of thousands of votes? It would be worthless for them. And also, I think it's important to remember that it hasn't been too many decades where, the people of the United States didn't have much more than maybe a high school education level. And so it's very possible that a very popular individual, I'll throw out a couple of names, Oprah, Brad Pitt, both being on the same ticket, are going to get all the popular vote, just like Jesse Ventura did in Minnesota and Arnold Schwarzenegger did in California, and they could turn out to be just horrendous leaders of this country. I personally know of half a dozen people that voted for Sarah Palin and McCain because they thought she was hot. I mean, you need to have checks and balances all the way along in this system in order to ensure the best, most qualified people are elected to office, and I think the smaller states would do themselves a huge disservice and be left out of any chance of being a voice in the elections if we went to a popular vote.
Well, I think it's true, as I said before, that campaigns would change, and there are places that would not be given as much attention as they are today, and some of those would be rural places, especially rural places in swing states today. So I think that would be a change. Interestingly, years ago, people thought that the real support for the Electoral College would come from the small states because they are a bit overrepresented in the Electoral College. I think today the debate is really much more along partisan lines. You have Democratic legislatures in very Democratic states passing this National Popular Vote Initiative. You have Republicans generally opposing it. There are certainly exceptions, but at least the types of states that have moved in that direction have been more Democratic, not small or large, but really Democratic-Republican divide.
Let's see. Fred in Madison, you got 30 seconds. We're almost out of time.
Yes,
Fred, go ahead.
Hi, I hope you can hear me. I wish the speaker would tell us a little more about how the winner-take-all convention became established in the 1800s, and how is it enforced? It's partly party discipline and partly law.
Okay. All right, and you've only got about a half a minute here.
Basically, it is state law. It's true that keeping the discipline, so that they remain true to their promise as an elector is a question of party discipline. But it's state law, and essentially it happened because when one state saw another state doing it, they realized that they wouldn't have as much power in the Electoral College. So states controlled by one party would move to winner-take-all system, and then the states controlled by the other party would say, well, we need to keep up with them and move in that direction. So it happened somewhat accidentally back in the early part of the 19th century, but it's what we have today in all but two states.
Okay, and we'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
My guest has been John Fortier, director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Rhonda Fanning produced this hour of programming, and I thank her. Stick around. We have another hour to go. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.